In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I discuss hiring VAs, struggling with engineering, bootstrapping versus raising funding, and more listener questions. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 340. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So where this week, sir?
Well, I have a website for you. It is called gofccyourself.com.
Really? I'm clicking on it right now. That sounds dubious. Is this safe for work, as they say?
It is safe for work. So this is actually created by the Last Week Tonight show with John Oliver. And the idea behind them putting together this website was that there's some pending discussions inside the FCC about whether to deregulate certain parts of the internet, specifically as it relates to internet service providers. And it allows them to essentially self-police themselves in a way that they decide whether or not what they're doing is morally correct and net neutral, which is obviously not a good thing for net neutrality in general. But the FCC has made it very difficult to get to the page where you can actually leave comments in support or against this particular piece of decision making in the process. So John Oliver and his team put together this website that's essentially just a redirect that takes you directly to the place where you can fill out the form and leave a comment. So if you're interested in contributing your voice to that net neutrality legislation, then go over to gofccyourself.com. I've already done it. It does take a few minutes. I thought it would take like 2 minutes, so I'm hesitant to say that because it took me like 10. But I think that it's well worth putting your voice in for them to hear it.
And it looks like there's another URL, dearfcc.org. That's D-E-A-R, as if you're writing a letter. And that what helps you kind of send a letter to the FCC in essence.
Yeah, it's the same type of thing, except that it's, I believe it sends a physical letter as opposed to just commenting directly on the FCC's website.
Got it. Very cool. Well, hey, we had a comment on last week's episode, and I wanted to bring it up. I thought it was a pretty thoughtful comment, and I appreciate it. It was from a guy named Yunos, and he said, hey, first-time commentator. He said, congrats, Mike, on reaching your MRR milestone. What makes it more impressive is you did it in spite of all the armchair criticism, so all the more power to you. That I hadn't even read that part. That's funny. He said, I did want to say that hearing Rob talk about hiring an in-house nanny and how everyone should get hired help was a little bit, perhaps, insensitive. Not sure if that's the right word, but Mike's response pretty much sums it up. It is similar to a guy who can afford to fly first class and tells everyone they can't imagine flying economy again and that everyone should go fly first class. And so I appreciated his comment and a couple things. First of all, I felt like the first class analogy was a little, maybe didn't translate to what I was saying, because flying first class is like, what, 5 times, 10 times more than normal flight. And there's the only value is comfort and perhaps snobbery. Whereas I was genuinely saying outsourcing stuff, it's not about having a live-in nanny. It's about not mowing your lawn is really what I was talking about, right? I had switched topics by this point to, if you're a founder and you're still mowing your lawn and you're pressed for time and you don't have time to spend with your kids or work on your company and you're still mowing your lawn or shoveling your snow or cleaning your own house, that's not a money decision at that point if you've had any type of success. I used to pay $55 every 2 or 3 weeks for a house cleaner. Most of us can swing that. None of this is stuff that I started doing after I sold my company. I started hiring the small amounts of outsourcing. I mean, over 10 years ago when I was literally making just a normal salary gig, but I was trying to do stuff on the side. And so I wanted to clarify that and also say, you know, I apologize if I came off insensitive. Did you feel like I did?
I don't think so. I mean, I actually thought it was kind of funny when you said, I'm not advocating outsourcing your parenting of your kids.
Because
I was like,
kids.
Why not? Like that, isn't that the point?
Mike's like, I am advocating outsourcing and raising your kids.
I was like, kids. Wait, you know, when would you decide to go against that idea?
Totally.
Yeah, no, I could definitely see how what you had said could be misconstrued. And I don't think that was your intent. Because as you said, like the conversation had kind of shifted from one topic to another in the middle of it. So
right. So I don't think everyone by any stretch should have some type of live-in nanny. Sherry and I had been talking about that for 5 or 6 years. We had been able to do it. We just didn't have the house that it worked for back in Fresno. So this is nothing to do with, it really doesn't have anything to do with suddenly, like, you know, having more money. So I'm not advocating everyone should get a live-in nanny. It's game-changing for us, but that's a personal choice. The part that I am saying that entrepreneurs and founders should do if you're strapped for time, and all of us are, is that you should be outsourcing more of your day-to-day grunt work. And that's a decision you're going to have to make early on. It's kind of like hiring a VA. I'm going to pound that drum forever, that if you're still answering your own email support and you're more than about 3 or 4 months into your product, you're making a bad choice. You can try to tell me it's not a bad choice, but I'm going to tell you over and over, based on my experience and the experience of everyone who I've told this to, who then hires someone and says, oh my God, why didn't I do this years ago, that you should be doing it. So it's a different thing, but hopefully that clears it up and is a little more helpful and people don't think I'm some type of pretentious D-bag.
Monster.
I've always tried not, always tried to be on this side of that argument. But
I do think that there are certain cases to be made where you don't outsource that stuff. For example, like mowing the lawn. Like, I find that sort of therapeutic because I listen to my headphones and podcasts and stuff like that while I do it. And, you know, that's a regularly scheduled thing that comes up versus something like snow blowing the driveway and taking care of that, where you're much less in control of the weather and those things pop up and it needs to be taken care of. But that is easier to make that decision on than something like mowing the lawn, where it's, you know, it's predictable, I'll say.
Yeah. And if it's relaxed, you're saying it's relaxing for you. That actually is a good argument for it. I would say, all right, then that's not a bad choice. I actually cook quite a bit because cooking is not a chore to me. It's actually something that I enjoy. I do outsource part of it. A lot of the prep, I use HelloFresh or Blue Apron. So I'm not going out shopping. It's more expensive for sure, but it saves me time. And cooking itself, the act, is similar to what you're saying. I typically have a glass of wine and I have, you know, a podcast playing. And so it is actually relaxing. And so that's a good point too, to bring up, is it's only if this is something that's detracting from your life.
Yeah. And I think that that's the point, is that, like, if there are certain things that you can outsource because they are detracting from your life or they're inconvenient. And that was kind of really the point that you were trying to make with the nanny, was that, like, there are times where it's inconvenient to drop what you're doing to do something like picking up the kids at a specific time. You don't have to be the one that does that. But again, that's very different than being the person there parenting your kids. Those are just two very, very different things. And I think that the distinction got muddled in the conversation is all. I also want to bring up a comment that we got. This one came from Josh Duty. Josh gave an attendee talk at MicroConf. And one of the things that he had talked about in his attendee talk was about SEO. And this relates back to episode 338. And he just said, hi, I just listened to episode 338, the summary of the Moz case study on ranking number one for competitive head terms. Really good stuff. I heard a couple of things that I'm going to try to keep improving the SEO at fearlesssalarynegotiation.com. I added the episode link and the case study to link to my MicroConf summary page, and I think my talk and some of the links on that page could help people get started with SEO. My talk was a 101 level talk, whereas I would say the Moz case study is a 201 plus. And he gives a website URL. It's joshduty.com/microconf. And we'll link that up in the show notes. But anyone who wants to go take a look at that, it's a really good overview of what his talk was. And it is some practical strategies if you're not quite to the level of where that Moz episode that we did and all the different things that they did for SEO, if you're not quite there yet, head over to this link. Again, it'll be in the show notes. And it gives a lot of the basic tactics and stuff that you can use to help your website rank in the search engines. And then last, before we get started, I did not know this, but apparently for the past 2 or 3 years, there has been a Viking combat training facility here in my hometown.
So do they teach you to fight with axes?
Well, I think that they put stuff over like the ends of them, but they, like, I saw them training one day out in a parking lot, and they have like these giant bow staffs with, like, they almost look like giant erasers or Q-tips or something like that. But they were like padded on the ends, and I don't know, they looked like they were ready to beat the snot out of each other in the parking lot.
That's awesome. And your town is not that big, so it's kind of odd that you wouldn't have known that.
I know. That was the part that just struck me as odd. It's like, and it's literally called like the Viking Combat Training Center.
That's fun. You know, when we were, last time we were in Italy, my son and I did gladiator training in Rome. And it was like a 1 or 2 hour little adventure where we had foam swords and you wore the helmet. And that stuff's bulky and heavy. It was super fun to learn kind of the different approaches to combat, though.
So what's on the agenda for today?
Today, we are answering listener questions, trying to play catch up. I think we have one voicemail and a few written questions. Our first question is from Richard Gorbett. And he says, hey, Rob and Mike, love the podcast. Only one I have to auto-download when a new one appears. A couple of years ago, there was a lot of chat about virtual assistants. Is it worth a new topic in one episode, as I suspect the dynamics may have changed? I'm thinking from a help desk perspective, but many, many uses for VA. It's coming to my thoughts as my latest idea is about to MVP in the next few weeks. Thanks. So what do you think about this? I don't know that it's so much different than the previous thoughts we've had. Maybe the specifics of hiring have changed slightly, but I think that, you know, we talked about 15 ways to use a virtual assistant. I think all of that's still the same. That stuff hasn't changed. What do you think?
Yeah, I would agree. I think the specifics of how to go out and find somebody and vet somebody to do those things has definitely changed over the years. But I don't think that the specifics of the types of stuff that you would have them do is going to change all that much. And it's probably going to be more of an evergreen topic, to be honest. It's just there's always ways to save yourself time. The one thing that I think that might change over time is that as the level of skills of people that are available at a certain hourly rate, that dynamic shifts over time, you might be able to find people who are more qualified to do things that are probably further along than what you would think that a typical VA would be capable of. But, you know, again, that's going to be shifting like the global economy in terms of who is available at what hourly rate and stuff like that. That's not really a dramatic shift in what you would have them do. It's just a matter of what people are skilled at a particular hourly rate.
Yeah. And I actually think the hiring process that at least the one I outlined most recently was through Odesk. And that's still where I would go today. I would either use that or I would use Chris Ducker's service, virtualstafffinder.com, or it's virtual staff finder. And that's the URL. If I recall, it was like $300 or $400 to pay them. And they basically vet a bunch of candidates and then they give you like the top three, and they guarantee them that if they, you know, they don't work out in the first whatever days, that they replace them and stuff. So if you have the funds, I would do that, and you're in a hurry. If you have less funds and more time, then the old Odesk approach that we've outlined, or I guess it's Upwork now, the Upwork approach that we've outlined in the past is what I would go back to at this point. Thanks for the question. Our next one is an anonymous question that he actually sent to me directly. And he says, "Hi, Rob, I'm in the process of creating a B2B SaaS app for universities, but I'm struggling with the engineering of the application. What resources, such as books, tutorials, would you recommend for developing a SaaS app on the web? I'm a huge fan of the podcast and of your book. Thanks for all your help." What do you think, Mike?
You know, it's funny that as I've been developing Bluetick, I've come across various topics where this type of thing would be very highly relevant. And I've looked around, and depending on what you're doing, it can be very difficult to find this type of stuff. And it kind of actually sparked the idea of writing a kind of like the technical side of developing a SaaS application, a book that basically covers that topic. The problem, obviously, like I just don't have the time to do that kind of thing. But there's also just a wide variety of topics that as a SaaS founder, you may run into them and you may not. It depends on the type of SaaS that you're building and how data intensive it is, how much search you have to do, if you have to do data indexing. And a lot of times you can get away with just very basic stuff. And then when it breaks, then you fix it. I think it's very easy to go down the path of trying to engineer something to work for the largest case that you could possibly envision your app doing, and then get into it and realize that you're not going to hit that for 6 months or a year or 3 years. And you've over-engineered the early stage stuff. There's certainly things in Bluetick where we've had to rewrite them two, three. I mean, there's sections of the code where I've rewritten it four or five times just because the back end stuff has scaled to that point. But if had I sat down and just designed it on day one to try and reach that scale, it would have taken me so much longer to get something out there. So I think you really have to just weigh what it is that you're trying to accomplish and what those short-term goals are, which, you know, your primary one should be get something working in front of people versus how do I make this thing survive in the long term? And unfortunately, like that's something that's sort of diametrically opposed to each other. You don't want to have to rewrite code more than once or twice if you don't have to. But at the same time, in order to take those shortcuts, you almost need to build those or sections of code as prototypes just to get to where you need to be and get that revenue in the door. In terms of looking around and trying to find specific resources, I'll be honest, I looked around and I could not find very many. There's all the generic stuff on how do I build an application or how do I use this particular type of technology? And those are great and helpful, but they don't give you a much broader picture of how do I handle like authentication or how do I handle permissions inside of a system? And there's different areas you can go into, like, you know, claims-based authorization and all these different things. But at the end of the day, you got to pick what is right for your application and what is going to get you as far along as possible with the least amount of effort.
Yeah, the hard part with this is if you get into like, how should I do authentication? It's going to depend from language to language, right? You should use the built-in .NET stuff for .NET, but in Rails, you should use the built-in Rails stuff. So you almost have to go one level higher and talk about concepts. I agree with you. I don't know of a single good book or tutorial or course about the high-level engineering side that's not language-specific. I went to Google and typed in how to build a SaaS application, and there's actually some decent stuff. There's a good conversation on Quora. There's a good article on Glenn Stovall's blog. And, you know, he's a MicroConf attendee. He talks about all the technology he would use, and it's like 19 apps in a row. Hey, Drip made the list. Cool. Thanks, Glenn. I hadn't even noticed that. It's kind of funny. I mean, that's where I would start. Again, I don't know of any tomes, you know, any books, any dead tree things that are out there. It's much more going to be about blogs, article here and there. I mean, I do know that there are people out there like Derek, my co-founder, has a blog called Scaling SaaS. It's at scalingsaas.com. And he talks about challenges that he's run into and how he's fixed them. But it's not a step-by-step tutorial, you know, or a deep dive into engineering a SaaS app. So perhaps there is a gap in the market here that someone would be interested in filling. Or if you have heard of some good resources for stuff like this, feel free to write in questions at Startups for the Rest of Us, and we'll be happy to mention them in a future episode.
Hi, this is Laura Roeder from Meet Edgar. Hey, guys. I was wondering about Rob's perspective on bootstrapping versus fundraising now that you are operating inside of LeadPages, a funded company. I'm a bootstrapper. I know you guys have been big proponents of bootstrapping over the years. What have you learned being inside of LeadPages about bootstrapped versus funded companies? And has it changed your point of view at all about what you might like to do in the future? Thanks.
So this is a really interesting question. You know, the hard part is, think about how I run a bootstrap company versus maybe how you run one versus Ruben Gomez versus Josh Pigford. Like, I don't know, you can say there's one way to run a bootstrap company. And so I can only compare the way I run them with the way that the LeadPages team runs them. And if you think about a funded company in Minneapolis run by, you know, Clay Collins and his two co-founders, started as a distributed company and then raised funding and grew to, you know, 170, 180 employees at this point, it's probably a different trajectory. And they've always been profitable. Different trajectory than a funded company in the Bay Area that maybe B2C has never been profitable and is hiring a boiler room of bros to make the phone calls. So there are a lot of different ways and thoughts around raising funding and different ways to run a company. And so I guess I want to couch that in advance by saying it's only one person's experience, you know, and it's with basically two companies comparing them to one another. What I've learned, the biggest thing I've learned, you know, moving to a funded company is that it's so freeing and amazing to not have to worry about resources, to not have to be concerned with adding a $200 a month server or upgrading the database server to a $2,000 a month box when you know it's going to fix your problems, but you just don't know if you have the money to do it. That is gone. I'm not saying money is infinite, but compared to the bucket we were in a year ago before the acquisition, money is essentially as close to that as you can get. Anytime we'll bring up a problem and we'll say, here's how to fix it, but it's going to cost this. That is just the cost is actually the afterthought in the conversation. That's very freeing, and it allows us to operate quickly. We can hire, we can pay market rates. It's like having the resources is crazy. And especially because we're not doing the crazy, I'm going to raise $20 million and do the B2C shuffle where we just hire way out ahead of sanity. You know, you hire 20 people before you hit product market fit. We're not doing that. We're literally hiring to scale. This is the perfect time at which I would have raised funding if we were going to, right? It's the point at which you have product market fit, you're growing quickly, and you're just pouring money into either scale the marketing or scale the engineering. So that's been cool. The other thing I've learned is that specialization is amazing. Like the fact that they don't have people who do support and customer success and marketing. Like we used to have at Drip when there were five of us. There's one person doing support. And to be honest, there's like eight people doing support for Drip. And marketing is then divided up into like, some people just write blog posts. That's all they do all day. And then there's this person and all they do is all the social paid acquisition. And then there's this other person and all they do is the search paid acquisition because they have the staff to do that. And specialization is extremely powerful because you can get so good at stuff. You know, and this is when we see these case studies like we talked about last week, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, about the SEO stuff. The reason those people are so good at that and can write that incredible case study is because that's all they did. That's all they did for 90 days straight was work on that one problem, and you can accomplish a lot. a lot doing that. I think another difference, and I don't think it's not a funded versus non-funded thing, but like Drip was an engineering-driven culture, right? Because I'm an engineer and so is Derek. LeadPages is a marketing-driven culture. So that's just, it's a different way to look at it, a different way to run a company. But that's not because they're funded. It's because of they've always been that way. Even when because Clay and Tracy and Simon bootstrapped LeadPages to, I don't even remember what the number was, but it was several million dollars in annual revenue. So they kind of are a bootstrap company that then raised funding. So I think those are some cursory thoughts. Could probably do about a 20-minute rant of, not even a rant, just a conversation of me talking about the differences. But I think those are probably the most pronounced.
I think the only thing I'd add to that is that there's this, I'll say, sort of a pervading fallacy that when you start talking to not self-proclaimed experts, but the people who are leading the masses when it comes to startups, you look at them and your immediate thought is, oh, they know what they're talking about and that's the way to build a business. And the reality is that is true to an extent. However, there are lots of ways to be successful and there's more than one path to do it. Like there's no one true path. There's no one silver bullet. There's no one way to do things. There's lots of ways to do it and be successful. And just because it worked for somebody else doesn't mean it's always going to work for you. And that when you're looking at those types of examples, that's one path. And there are lots of others that may or may not work for you. And it's about finding what will work for you.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's always these big things about don't raise funding because you'll lose control or you'll make bad decisions because you have too much money or you'll feel all this pressure from your investors. And I'm not the founder or the CEO of LeadPages, but I don't feel like I've lost control, like we're being pushed to make bad decisions because we have quote unquote too much money, or that, you know, there's all this pressure from investors. Perhaps, again, you know, perhaps the board or the CEO, Clay, feels different than that. It's interesting that it's not this black and white dichotomy that so many people make it out to be. And you and I have never done that, right? We've never been anti-funding. We've always been anti, like, the dumb B2C startups that have no product trying to raise all this money and go viral and do ad. I mean, it's the stupid Silicon Valley stuff. But for 10 years, I've been saying there's a right time and a right place to raise funding. And it's I think it's post-product market fit. You bootstrap it to that, and then you add the fire to grow the company. And typically, it's going to be more B2B. Although if you had a B2C that had hit, I think there's a good time to raise it as well. So yeah, it's really interesting. There's a lot more to talk about. Maybe we'll record an episode in the future about kind of revisit that whole topic.
Yeah, I think you and I are more anti-pipe dream, where you have something that you're putting out there, but you're not charging for it and you don't have any way of making money. And the reason you need funding is in order to increase your reach and get it in front of more people. And then at some point down the road, you'll figure out how to make money from it. Like if you can't do that very early, then it makes it difficult to build a business out of it.
Right. And we're anti building slide decks and asking for permission instead of actually building a company, right? It's like you should be able to build your company to the point where people want to invest without any funding. I mean, it's very, very rare exceptions, maybe hardware. Although even these days, I would say do a Kickstarter. Maybe, you know, there's something with incredible computing power or something that you can't have access to. And I would say build something simpler first. Yeah, I mean, there's, for the most part, most of what we all do, you can bootstrap that to the point where it becomes very interesting to investors.
Well, I think that about wraps us up for today. If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforrecipes.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupsforrecipes.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.